Hi everyone and welcome to Memcast. My name's Rachel Saville and I'm a respiratory reg here in the East Midlands. Today I'm going to be talking to you a bit about PE follow-up and a condition called CTEF. As you probably already know, PE is quite a common clinical presentation on our wards and ambulatory care departments. The incidence of PE is 60 to 70 cases per 100,000 and half of these develop while patients are in hospital or in long-term care. The rest are idiopathic or in those with recognised risk factors. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail about this here, as you've already had a episode on PE from Demi. So if you wanted to listen to that, that's number 48. And in that episode, they talk about epidemiology, presentation, the investigations of PE, and acute management of PE, including thrombolysis. So my question to you is, have you ever wondered what actually happens at that 3-month follow appointment you've arranged for someone with a PE? Before you've discharged them, you've probably started them on an anticoagulant and may have arranged for them to have an outpatient echo. The anticoagulant, usually a DOAC, but might be low molecular weight heparin or warfarin, is to prevent further clots developing. So not actually to dissolve the clots that are already there. The fibrin in the clots dissolved enzymatically by plasmin over time. So at that 3-month follow-up appointment, we're going to do a few things. And I've got 6 things for you to remember here, okay? So firstly, we're going to assess for provocation. A provoked PE is caused by things like surgery. A PE could develop about 2 days after hip fractures. If it's post-knee replacement, which are tourniquet, you could get a PE on the same day. There's risk factors like long-haul flights that are longer than 6 hours, or prolonged immobility. And if people are really sick in hospital or admitted to ITU, then that could be counted as a provoked PE. Pregnancy and cancer are also provoking risk factors. We call a PE unprovoked if it was associated with a combined oral contraceptive pill. There's no evidence that the COVID vaccine provokes PE, although the acute illness itself is prothrombotic. Any flights that are less than 6 hours don't count as a provoking factor, so your flights to Tenerife don't count. If you can't find a cause, that also sits in the unprovoked category. The reason this is important is we secondly need to decide how long we're going to anticoagulate these patients for. This is based on a number of factors, and we want to assess their risk of recurrence, patient preferences, and check in with them about any side effects. There's certainly been a shift towards lifelong anticoagulation, which is usually done with a DOAC. The decision on whether to continue anticoagulation is made at that 3-month mark, and it's based on the likelihood of recurrent VTE events and the bleeding risk. If they've got a high risk of recurrence, that's if they've got active cancer or they've had a recurrent VTE in the absence of major transient or reversible factors, or they've got antiphospholipid syndrome, then we definitely recommend lifelong anticoagulation. If the patient's risk factors fall into an intermediate category, which means they've got a 3-8% risk per year of recurrent VTE, then you should still consider lifelong anticoagulation. And this decision is actually quite complex and is made on a case-by-case basis, but this is a rough guide. So these people tend to have transient or reversible risk factors, like they've had their PE after minor surgery, or a short hospital admission, less than 3 days, or they were confined to bed at home for more than 3 days with an acute illness. They've been on flights, they've had estrogen therapy or contraception, or they're pregnant postpartum. They might have non-malignant persistent risk factors, inflammatory bowel disease or active autoimmune disease, or we might not ever identify a risk factor for them. So you're weighing up their risk and considering it along with their patient's preference. If the patient's had a major transient reverse risk factor, i.e. they've had a provoked PE, like surgery with a general anaesthetic over 30 minutes, or if they're in hospital for more than 3 days with an acute illness or exacerbation of their chronic illness, or they've had their PE post-trauma with a fracture, for instance, then these people actually have quite a low risk of the VTE reoccurring. And these people tend to only need 3 months worth of treatment and then it can stop. I say that, but if I had a patient who had been really sick and needed thrombolyzing or intensive care admission, I would be suggesting lifelong treatment to them, even if it was a reversible risk factor that led them to have a PE in the first place. So there's some nuances to the decisions and no blanket rule that fits all. It takes a little bit of clinical acumen and patient wishes as well as risk factors into consideration. If you're going to be continuing anticoagulation lifelong, you can consider reducing the dose after 6 months to a half dose regimen in non-cancer patients. This is to reduce that bleeding risk. If they've got on well with whatever treatment they were on, they can continue it. And if it's not well tolerated, then apixaban can be used, as it tends to be a better tolerated DOAC. And if the patient declines anticoagulation lifelong, then the current NICE guidance is that we should consider either aspirin 75 or 150 milligrams, but this is off-label, and I'm not sure practically how useful that guidance is, as I'm not sure how many people would actually be happy taking a drug like aspirin but not a DOAC. There was one thing that I was actually quite shocked about when I learned about it, and it's how often patients could get a second PE after they've had their first. So if you've had an unprovoked PE and you stop the anticoagulation, there's a 10% risk that they would have another PE at 1 year. And that increases by 5% every year thereafter. So 3 years later, they've got a 20% risk of having had another PE. And VTE reoccurrence is more likely post-PE than DVTs, and it's more common in males than females. So the third thing to do is to consider screening for cancer. Now, clearly the new NICE guidance tones this down from before, so not everyone with an unprovoked PE gets a CT, chest, abdo, pelvis. But it is worth mentioning that we need to check that this has been done properly. So has there been appropriate basic blood sent, full blood count, ewe's knees, calcium? Has there been a urine dip done? Have they had an appropriate clinical examination? So that includes a breast examination for women. And have they had red flag symptoms reviewed? This should have happened during their inpatient stay, but I usually go through this again at follow-up because it's something not to miss. If there are any concerns that there's an underlying cancer, then further investigations can be arranged. The fourth thing to look at is, have they recovered properly? Is it worth doing any further investigations? So 19 out of 20 people after a blood clot get back to normal. But if they haven't returned back to normal, that could be for a number of reasons. One thing to look out for is a condition called CTEPH, which stands for chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. But many people have post-PE syndrome and just take a while to pick back up again. This can be due to a combination of deconditioning, weight gain, slow recovery, and it does normally settle, but it can take some time, around 6 weeks or so. Patients might have other issues that are contributing to their breathlessness. They might have dysfunctional breathing or another underlying respiratory disease. So if your patient's still breathless at 3 months following an acute PE, the first thing to do would be to arrange an echo and do a workup for other etiologies of dyspnea. So you might want to consider things like pulmonary function testing, exercise and nocturnal oximetry, an ECG, a BNP test and hemoglobin to rule out anemia and heart failure, and a review of the echocardiogram to look for left-sided heart disease rather than right-sided heart disease, which would be more associated with CTEPH. And you'd also review the CT angiogram that they'd already had to look to see if there was any parenchymal lung changes that could explain this patient's breathlessness. If you think that they might have pulmonary hypertension on that echo, then we're really looking at referring them over to a specialist pulmonary hypertension unit. And for us here in King's Mill Hospital, that would usually be Sheffield Teaching Hospitals. Before we sent them there, we'd try to get a CTPA or a VQ scan. Really only need the Q part of the VQ scan, the perfusion part rather than the ventilation. Or we could do a SPECT CT if possible. But at the Pulmonary Vascular Disease Centre, they would usually do things like a right heart catheter. They would look at a CT angiogram. They might repeat a CTPA if not already done. And then there's other tests that they would do, like a 6-minute walk test, make sure the patient has had an ECG done, look at CPET testing potentially. And they might consider other investigations, such as a cardiac MRI. Obviously, these are specialist investigations done at a specialist centre, so it wouldn't be expected at the respiratory outpatient appointment. I'm not going to go into too much more detail about pulmonary hypertension investigations and management, as Christina did do a podcast episode on pulmonary hypertension recently, which goes into the different classes of pulmonary hypertension and investigations. So I'll let you have a listen to that separately. Now, if based on the echo and the other investigations, you think that there's a low probability of pulmonary hypertension and there's no other cause for the breathlessness, again, you would start with that VQ or SPECT scan. But if that was negative, then you would assume it was down to post-P related breathlessness, and then that person might just need to go for exercise or pulmonary rehab. If the VQ scan or SPECT CT was positive, then they would go on to have a CPET, and if that was suggestive of peripheral vascular disease, again, they'd be referred to that pulmonary vascular disease specialist unit. So to summarise that, not everybody needs a 3-month follow-up echo, though it is recommended if the patient's still breathless at 3 months and if there was right heart strain on the initial CTPA. It's just nice to know that it's improved. So an echo is not routinely required after every pulmonary embolism. One thing to tell your patients though is that if they're ever more breathless post VTE, then they need to see a medical professional and be assessed for either recurrent VTE or CTEF, even if it's years after the clot. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about CTEF in a moment and we're going to circle back to that. The fifth thing that we're going to talk about is follow-up imaging. If the patient's had an infarct associated with their pulmonary embolism, they should have had a 6 to 8 week follow-up chest x-ray to check that the consolidative changes have resolved. Infarcts related to PEs cause inflammatory change, and so there's quite a low threshold for antibiotics in the acute phase. And if there was any enlarged lymph nodes on the CTPA, which can be associated with PE, you could also consider a follow-up CT scan. And then my sixth and last thing to do is to think about thrombophilia testing. Now, I don't want you to offer this to people that are continuing treatment because it's not going to change their management. But people that you might want to consider thrombophilia testing in are people with recurrent VTEs, patients that are less than 40 with a VTE with no obvious risk factors, so your young patients. If they've had thrombosis secondary to pregnancy, a pill or HRT, or if they've had a thrombosis at an unusual site. So that's normally cerebral, mesenteric, portal or hepatic veins. If it's an unprovoked PE, then I'd recommend checking for antiphospholipid syndrome. And an unprovoked PE with someone with a first degree relative of the VTE, you need to also screen for hereditary thrombophilia. Now, the thrombophilia testing can be done at any time, but you can get false positives if you do this early. And there's a caveat that you can't do the lupus testing if they're on a DOAC, and you can't do the thrombophilia screen if they're on warfarin. So those are your six things to look out for. So you're going to be checking, are they provoked or unprovoked? Decide how long to anticoagulate the patient for. Consider screening for cancer. Have they recovered? Do you need to do any further investigations? Do they need any follow-up imaging? And have you thought about thrombophilia testing? Now, if treatment fails and they get another clot whilst quote-unquote on anticoagulation, first of all, you need to check, are they adherent to the anticoagulation treatment? And you need to look for other sources of hypercoagulability. You might need to increase the dose of the anticoagulant or change to an anticoagulant with a different mode of action. Okay, so I said I was going to cycle back to CTEF and just explain that in a little bit more detail. So CTEF is chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, and it's when you have an elevated blood pressure in the pulmonary arteries, which is caused by chronic blood clots obstructing the free flow of blood through the lungs. and it actually happens in nearly 4% of patients with PE, and it usually presents within 2 years of their PE. You can see webs in chronic PEs in the vessels on a CTPA, and if they have a mean pulmonary arterial pressure of greater than 50, their five-year survival is actually less than 15%. So it's quite important complication of PE to pick up. As left untreated, these patients can get really poorly. The management for CTEPH is lifelong anticoagulation. They might need diuretics to manage their heart failure or oxygen. Then we need to determine whether the patient is fit for surgery, balloon angioplasty, or pulmonary hypertension meds. So the surgery for CTEPH is a pulmonary endarterectomy, and that's for large central, quite proximal clots. And it's an open surgery. The surgeons get 20 minutes to clear out as much clot as they can from each lung. But there is a 5 to 10% risk of stroke with this. Balloon angioplasty is slightly less invasive and can get more distal to surgery. They get a fine wire passed down into the blood vessels, and the balloon is pumped up to squeeze the blockage to the sides and restore flow to that area of the lung. Now, if they're not fit for either surgery or balloon angioplasty, they might end up on pulmonary hypertension meds. There's a soluble guanylate cyclase inhibitor called riociguat, which can be used for pulmonary hypertension. If they do get a endarterectomy, so the surgery for CTEPH, the follow-up that they get is quite intense. They get an echo every year for 5 years. We need to check their compliance with anticoagulation and see if they've had any further clots. And we assess their response to the endarterectomy. So if their response is good, it's unlikely they're going to develop pulmonary hypertension in the future. But we do a repeat right heart catheter 3 to 6 months post-surgery to assess if pulmonary hypertension is present. So a lot of this workup and investigation is done by us respiratory physicians referring on to the specialists, cardiologists and respiratory physicians in these tertiary centres. But it's useful to understand what we're looking out for, what initial investigations we need to do if someone's still breathless at 3 months. So that's a really whistle-stop tour of CTEPH and a little bit about what we do in the PE follow-up clinic within respiratory. Hope you guys have found that useful. Let us know if you have any questions or any topics in particular that you'd like us to cover. And if you haven't already, check out our question of the week over on our Instagram page at mem.cast. And we'll see you again next week for our next episode of Memcast.